Justify. Prove to be right or reasonable. Justification is at the heart of all legal and political argument. But at a time when argument itself is slave to appearances, it is time to bring back a culture of justification. Justify, a podcast on law and politics in India from the Vidhi Center for Legal Policy, hosted by Orgho Sengupta.
Welcome to another season of Justify. India is gearing up for the next general election soon. Alliances, seat sharing and swing states are the talk of the town. Election frenzy is beginning to grip the nation. But curiously, the role of the youth in influencing the outcome of these momentous elections is largely missing, except as rhetoric. In the 2019 general elections, out of the total 900 million voters, over 45 million were in the age group of 18 to 19, of whom only 15 million or less than 15 million actually cast their votes. Most studies on the subject indicate that interest in elections amongst the youth is rapidly declining. In a small attempt to course correct, this season of Justify, titled Why the Youth Matters, is dedicated to the role of the youth and why policy matters must play a critical role in their vote. Each episode of this season will be dedicated to one issue of contemporary law and policy which we feel ought to affect the youth's vote in the upcoming polls. It's our view at Justify that the first-time voter needs to think about how critical issues of law and policy will matter to the future of the country they call home. Today, in our first episode, we will discuss one such emotive issue that was relevant not just at the time when the Constitution was drafted and the Republic was formed, but continues to remain relevant today, and that is the question of language. Language is not only a means of communication, it is a storehouse of our literature, our stories, our culture, and our history. It's actually what makes us human. But there is a policy angle to language as well. How can language foster a feeling of nationhood? Does it necessarily mean that we need to have one language? Can multilingualism be said to be harmonious with an idea of nationhood? When we lose languages, don't we lose entire knowledge systems? Joining me today is Professor Anvita Ambi, a Padma Shri awardee and former president of the Linguistic Society of India. Dr. Abhi was former professor of linguistics at the School of Language, Literature and Culture Studies at JNU and has been credited with developing the department. Her research spans all six language families in India, from the Himalayas to the Andaman and Nicobar Islands. She is an adjunct professor of linguistics at the Simon Fraser University in Canada and serves on the expert committee on the UNESCO World Atlas of Languages. Professor Abhi, welcome to Justify.
Thank you, Namaskar. I'm very happy to join Justify. This is my very first entry into this, and I hope your audience would be happy to know about languages or language that I'm going to talk about. Thanks for inviting me.
No, it's our pleasure. I'm sure this is the first of many podcasts that you'll do, and I'm sure our audience will be keenly awaiting what you have to hear, what you have to say. So let's start with a generic question. As a linguist, you study the structure of languages. Why do you think linguistics is important?
Well. You see, linguistics is actually science of language and languages. We study various kinds of languages spoken around the world, and each language is constituted and evolved in very different way from other. So the diversity of languages is imbibed into the structure of the languages. And structure of the languages are not just the grammatical, you know, rules, how a word is formed or how a sentence is formed. But if once linguists have the knack of untying the complex knots of the grammatical structures, and we find out that how a particular grammatical structure has been formed, what does it emote and how does it relate to the society? To give you a very small example, most of the Indian languages have two or three different second person pronouns, that is the equivalent of English you, right? In English, you have only one you. But in Hindi, you have tu, tum, and aap. In Bangla, you have tui, tumi, apni. In Punjabi, you have ni. In Tamil, you have ni, ningar. You know, and so on and so forth. The entire country, leaving aside some of the languages of the Northeast, has three different yous. Now, why do you need three different yous? Because our language, because our society is so stratified, because we have different kind of social human relations, intimacy plays a very important role for us. So when the mother talks to her son as tu, it's not considered derogatory, right? It's not considered intimidating. It's considered very close, very, very, very loving. In fact, when mother says aap, I mean, if my mom says aap to me, I would feel very funny, and I immediately know maybe she's very angry with me and she wants to distance me from her.
In fact, that's actually quite interesting, because I come from Calcutta, and in Bengali, of course, my mother would say tui to me without any question. And when I came, I now live in Delhi for the last 10 years, and I constantly hear parents talking to their toddlers saying aap, and it keeps jarring in my ears. So it's actually
very interesting. Even I have noticed this, why Punjabi people always call their children or address their children up. And when I ask them, the answer comes that they said that, oh, we want to teach them that they should use up to everybody, which is ridiculous. I mean, we never had, as a Hindi speaker, we never had problems of distinguishing between tu, tum, and up, and also the choices. You see, the brain, it understands the choices that we make is very important to whom to address as tu, whom to address as tum, and whom to address as an aap. But you know, your same mother, suppose speaking about you on a stage, she would never say tui. She will say aapne aise kiya tha, aur aapne erekam koreche. Something That's like right. that. Right? So That's she right. is giving you respect in public. So the tu changes to aap in public because the addresser wants to give you respect. So what I was saying, that the structures are important to give us the social, now this just one particular fact alone gives you the social or the nature of the social organization that we live in. Similarly, there are many, many aspects of linguistic structures that are very important to learn, because they tell you about the worldview of the society. Great Andamani's grammar exposed me to the worldview, which I'll talk about it later. But I realized that the hunter and gatherer society considers and conceives their world very differently than us, you see. There's another interesting example I can give you, because the words or the lexicon in a grammar of any language basically tells you how many ways, what are the diverse ways of perception. You know, there are 9 different shades of blue in the Maya language of Arizona. An Amazonian forest, because this is a South American language. 9 different shades of blue, they have these words, because the butterflies that they see in the forest have different 9 colors. You see? Right. 9 different colors of blue. So they have these 9 different names for these blue shades. But when the dictionary for this language was made in Spanish, so the Porwa Spanish dictionary, when it came out, since Spanish does not have 9 different shades of blue, the blue color was translated into 3. And when this dictionary was taught to the second and the third generation of Maya speakers, they only learned 3 shades of blue. When they learned for 3 shades of blue, when they go back to the forest, they only perceive 3 shades of blue. They don't perceive 9 more. You see my point?
So that's fascinating. That's fascinating, because actually it works both ways. It's not just the fact that words are responding to what you see around you, but it's also that if you don't have words for it, then you don't see those things around you.
I suddenly remembered that when we were collecting names for Tes in Orissa, I realized they were saying that we don't have any more names for taste left. But when we had 1,700 varieties of rice, can you believe it, Ark? 1,700 varieties of rice they used to grow before the Green Revolution took place. And they said each rice We used to cook differently. Each rice had a taste different. And then we had a lot of taste. But now it's all, you know, uniform agriculture. It's totally homogenized. So we have lost the names of the taste. We've also left the perception of the taste. We only taste this rice that we produce, which is absolutely good for nothing. They say, we, no matter how much you eat, doesn't fill you, doesn't taste. And they say, we just used to use that rice and we used to feel, because, you know, they also told me about the medicinal properties of the water that they take out of that rice and their right. names, which they said in stomach ache, we used to drink the water of this particular rice.
Right, right.
You know, those kind of things. So the language actually imbibes and in itself a large amount of indigenous knowledge.
So no, this is an absolutely fascinating, fascinating point. And I think there are a lot of threads to unpack there, Professor Abbi. So why don't we unpack it through the language family that you have done some really seminal work in, which I know absolutely next to nothing of, which is the great Andamanese language. And could you tell us a little bit more about your work? And for our listeners, Professor Abbi's discovery was that the great Andamanese language is part of an altogether different language family and is now credited as a distinct language family in India. So could you tell us a little bit more about your work with the great Andamanese language and what the status of these languages is today?
Oh my God, Arg, that's a long topic.
Since my I know you could speak about it for 2 years.
And you know, I can go on and on, but and you know, my immersion
in brief for non-linguists like us who are interested but have no knowledge.
Okay, I will. My immersion is so much in this family of languages that it's difficult to be very objective, but nonetheless, I'll tell you for your audience, you see. Before I started work on Great Andamanese, Andamanese languages were considered as one family by linguists and anthropologists and others, having three branches, Jarwa, Onge, and Great Andamanese. In 2001, I took a pilot survey of the entire set of Andaman Islands, that is from north to south in Little Andaman, where Onge is spoken. I lived in the jungle with Onges, that's a very difficult journey anyway, from Port Blair to Little Andaman. You know, we had to cross the creeks with crocodiles, laden with crocodiles, you won't believe, such fat crocodiles I've never seen in my life. And the hut I was living in was always frequented by green snakes. You know,
you could really write a book about this.
Yeah, it was horrible. Anyway,
but did you speak Onge yourself?
No, I don't. In fact, linguists never speak the language they're working on.
Oh, but I see. That's interesting.
Within 2 or 3 days, that's very interesting because it's a science of language. And as I always call that, we are speech detectives. So, and through 2-3 days, language is a very rule-governed phenomena. So we immediately try to discover the rules of the forming a sentence. Once we know the rules, we start forming the sentences without phonological analysis so that we can pronounce as well, as good as they are. And interestingly, always the native speakers correct us. No, this is not this, this is not this, this is way. So, you know, we learn by mistakes and in 2 or 3 days, we go sort of, you know, catch up with.
Right.
So I think that when I worked on Onge, then I came back, I worked a little bit on Jarwa and Great Andamanese, and I realized that Great Andamanese is a class apart. And on my pilot survey, I presented my research in Max Planck Institute of Evolutionary Anthropology, which is an MPI, one of the famous ones in Germany. And many linguists and scientists were sitting there and they thought I should go deep into Great Andamanese because what I'm presenting is something which is they had never heard of. So this was in 2003. And in 2005, the geneticist, the molecular biologist from CCMB worked on the mtDNA samples and some blood samples of Onge and Great Andamanese and reached the conclusion that Great Andamanese and Onge constitutes different haplogroups, that is M31 and M32. So they said that genealogically they are very, very different groups, you know, haplogroups. Then somebody pointed to them that what you are saying, a linguist had already said it earlier, and they didn't believe it. So I remember I addressed the European Molecular Biology Congress to tell them that how linguists can also, you know, unearth the distinctiveness of language or languages, and hereby and so thereby the communities. And so they were asking me, does the linguistics provide robust markers? And yes, it does, because once you do the analysis and the grouping very carefully, you do. And Great Andamanese, then I got deep into it and I studied the language. I talked to them and I realized many interesting features of this Great Andamanese language.
But is it one language or is it a family of languages?
No, it is a family of 10 languages, but most of them are extinct now. In fact, right. Most of them were extinct during the British rule in 1935. But when I reached the island, there were remains of 4 languages. So right. There were, this was Jero and Khora, Sare and Bo. And each speaker had, you know, some kind of what you can say the underlying structures of its languages, especially from lexicon, you know, they had maintained their languages, but the grammar is of Jero language. So the base, so it's kind of a mixed language that they speak now, which I call PGA, Present Great Andamanese. And right. Draws its lexicon from 4 languages, but the grammar, as I said, is based on Jero. And that grammar is very, very unique. And when I discussed with the geneticists, I realized that the Andamanese are the remnants of the very first migration that took place out of Africa 70,000 years ago.
Right.
And they also, from genetics study, I realized also that the Great Andamanese specifically remained in isolation for a very long time. They didn't let anybody step on their island till the Britishers established the penal colony, as you know, Kalapani, right. In 1868. So only from 1868 they came into contact with the Britishers and the Bengali Babus who came with the Britishers from Kolkata. So, right.
But could you tell us what is unique about this, the grammar and the structure that you were talking about of the language?
The uniqueness comes from their perception or their worldview. And that's what I said in the beginning, why language structures are so important. You know, they divide their body into 7 divisions, theoretically or philosophically, you can say. And each division has several parts. And over the years, I'm sure these parts divisions must have had names, but they have been over the years, you know, grammaticalized. That means they have become shortened. So one word has become like some kind of an affix, like prefix. So these are like prefixes. And for example, so these 7 divisions have 7 different sounds. And these divisions are attached to every part of speech in the language. So you
could
know
the example, a bit hard to follow. Yeah.
Yeah, for example, you know, when we learn grammar, we know that there are parts of speech like nouns, adjectives,
yes.
Verbs,
yes.
You know. Now, in this language, what happens, each part of speech, each noun, each adjective, each verb, each adverb has to be preceded by a particular body division marker. Without that, you cannot speak it. For example, the word for tongue is taat. But you have said this, you have to say right. Atat. So anything which refers to the mouth or origin right. has to be preceded by a. So saliva, since it comes from the mouth, is a poop, but it has to be say a poop.
No, but what about, but what about if I wanted to say chair, would I say like head chair or like tongue chair or mouth chair or something like that?
No, chair is a separate object. Most of the objects, inanimate objects, and the flora and fauna are not preceded by this. But let me give you the example how it is uniqueness that you asked me. This is all right, the tongue and the saliva example that I gave you. But if you say somebody is mute or I don't want to use the word dumb, mute, somebody who cannot speak, That is the adjective of the characteristic feature of the mouth. So you have to say, not the word is mu, but you cannot say mu, you have to say amu.
Amu. I see.
Similarly, if somebody is greedy, you have to say ajom. You see?
I see, ajom.
In the verb, when you say keep quiet in the class, that means basically you want people to shut their mouth, right?
Yes.
So keeping quiet is thitul, but you can't say thitul. You have to say athitul. Now, this, you know, another example very interesting for your audience would be that, you know, air again is a prefix which is for external body parts like arms, shoulders, and, you know, face and so on and so forth. So if somebody is very beautiful, like a Miss World or somebody, you can say air bungoi, because bungoi is. But if somebody is very nice, like means you say, she's a beautiful person, you know, inside. You have to use that body division marker, which is reserved for the internal body parts, which you cannot see, like liver,
kidney. Fascinating.
So same adjective bungoi will have two forms, air bungoi and a bungoi, depending what you're talking about. So this is a very unique, and I had never addressed this kind of complex problem. I have worked on more or less 100 languages of India by now, but never came this kind of a thing. You know,
this is really really fascinating. And you said, however, that tragically this is almost extinct. And could you tell us a little bit about what the status of these languages is, and more generally, what happens when a language family dies?
You know, the status of this language is very dismal right now, because when I reached the island in 2001, there were 10 speakers, you know, 10, and they all did not speak the language, only 10, but they all did not speak their language because they did not have many people to talk to, you see. So but now there are only 3 or 4 speakers left, and they have forgotten their language. They don't speak much. So it's a very, very bad state. So one language family which had 10 languages in its fold and 5,000 people in the beginning of the 20th century are now just have 3 or 4 speakers left, and they reside in Strait Island. So the Great Andamanese, or the Great Andamanic language, is only on the verge of extinction. The moment and the day these people will leave this earth, the language will be gone. So this is a
And there's no script, or there's no written literature in this language?
No, I'm the only one who has written about extensively. I have produced a dictionary with sound files, so you can hear the sounds of each word that is described in the language. It's a pictorial dictionary, so there are images and there are sounds, and it's a multilingual. It's in Hindi, English, and Great Andamanese. And, you know, the latest book on voices from the Lost Horizon is the very first and the last book, I suppose, of Andamanese oral tradition. It has very rare, interesting 10 stories with translation and 46 songs sung by Boa Senior, who's no more. She was the last speaker of the Bo language. And these songs, the book comes with a video. So it's an amazing book, because there are QR codes. You can scan them. It takes you to the video of the songs.
So we'll certainly link that in the notes, so that our listeners can also follow those links and listen to those videos. It sounds fascinating. This is something that I'm sure very few of us will have known anything about. And so it's great learning for us that we are witness to something so tragic, that a language family that had 5,000 speakers at the turn of the 20th century now has 3 to 4 speakers who are really the last vestiges of that language. And it's sad, but it's also wonderful with the work that you've done, that we will not forget these languages.
You said it right, Arge. I'd like to add that your audience may like to read my latest article in Scientific American in the June issue. And if they read it online, there are many links. They have been very nice. They have given the links of these videos that you just talked about. But in addition to that, they've linked to my website, which is www.andamanese.org, which has a lot of information but there are other links also. But the Scientific American article, I was commissioned to write this long essay, and I have described the language, in as easy term as I could, you know, not taking into account a lot of linguistic jargon as I just said.
Right. We'll certainly do that. And I think that as sort of our listeners are primarily students of law, humanities, social sciences, as well as the sciences, and several others who are just generally curious, let's turn to the role of the state or the government in both promotion of language and also ensuring that these traditions that you have, these ways of life, essentially, that language families represent are protected. So in India, there is a significant debate on first, what the state considers a language. So this, according to the census, a language is a language if more than 10,000 people speak it. So according to that definition, Great Andamanese would not be a language or would never ever have been a language even at the turn of the 20th century. The 8th schedule of the constitution, of course, has 22 languages which are sort of spoken across the country, the more better known ones. But it also faces a lot of criticism for excluding languages. And we've, of course, heard recently calls, not by the highest levels of government, but by many people in terms of Hindi being the official language and one nation having one language. So as a linguist, how do you see the role of the state in promoting languages?
That's, again, a very interesting, very current, but a question which needs a lot of time, you know. For me to explain, I'll try to be brief. You see, the role of state for promoting language should be based on our linguistic diversity and multiplicity of languages, meaning thereby we are a multilingual country. We have been multilingual. It is not a new concept. It's a multilingual society, but so state has to take into consideration the fact that we have grown up in the multilingual atmosphere. When a child comes to school, he's not a monolingual. He's already well-versed in the language of his comfortable level, whatever it is, a home language or a society language. He's already comfortable with that. So we cannot thrust a child at the age of 5 with the exclusive language as a medium of instruction, because it's a double disadvantage. He's a double disadvantage student. He not only is learning a new language, is also learning the new language as a medium of instruction, you see?
Right.
And he's forgetting his entire knowledge base and the entire way of perceiving the world and the perception and the cognitive abilities which he walks in with in his language. So it's very important that the language of the child or the home language or the language that he's comfortable with, or the whatever the language, because sometimes it's a contact language, sometimes it's the language that the society, uses it. For example, many of the tribal languages in Jharkhand use Sadri. So Sadri can be the language of the child. So whatever the language is that the child is should be taken into consideration. But coming to your point of, the language, 22 languages, perhaps you have noticed that the census reports, 2011 census reports, 1,369 mother tongues.
That's right.
The census does not want to label it either a language or as a dialect. They have been very careful. So they said 1,369 mother tongues because these are rationalized mother tongues. If you go to the data a little deeper, you realize that they have mentioned that there are reported mother tongues are 19,569. Sorry.
Right.
19,569 are reported mother tongues, but they have classified it in 1,369. I will like to go with the rationalized classified mother tongues because people have the habit of, not knowing the name of the language. When the reporter comes to ask them, they say whatever it comes to their mind. So somebody can say, I'm a Teli, I speak Teli language because he works in the oil. There are all kinds of reports. I can say, I'm speaking Abbi language. So he'll report Abbi.
That's right. So let's take 1369. Yeah.
1369, out of that, if you go by the hierarchy, the topmost hierarchical status in our communities of English, which is not part of the 1369 mother. No, they are part of the 1369 mother tongue. They're not part of the scheduled languages. So right. The scheduled languages are 22. Right. So 22 and English is 23. Now, out of these 22 scheduled languages, there are some other varieties which you can call dialects, which I don't like the word language dialect, and I'll come to it why. Because there are varieties of scheduled languages, there are 101. Okay. Then there are 98 non-scheduled languages. They comes next to in the hierarchical scale. It's all almost like upward pyramid. And then there are dialects or the varieties of non-scheduled languages of 50. So in effect, 272 languages are considered classified. Out of 272, one is English. So 271 is declared by the government of India that these are languages. Now, there are languages more than something like if you take the figure
1369, then you're talking about at least another 1100 languages which are not classified.
Yeah, so there are exactly 1097 languages which are not recognized and they are called others. That means they are spoken by less than 10,000 speakers. Now, what is this? I mean, this almost looks like ignoring the linguistic diversity and the multiplicity of languages that are there in our country. So this is not, and then there are many sign languages for which we have no data. I know there are more than 2 million signers in our country, Right. So that's also in a very, very much well-recognized language all over the world, because those people have right to, that is one mode of language signing.
Yes.
Yeah, communication, actually language is more than communication. It's your whole life history,
right.
And it's your identity. And more than that, it's your identity.
Right.
So the language dialect question is a very tricky, it's a political question, to be very frank,
Right.
Example, if you look at the census report of Hindi, it says there are 57 varieties. So under right. Hindi, there are 57 names of, I would say, of languages. They are not dialects. But they are considered dialects because they are under the rubric or the one big umbrella of Hindi. Now, for example, Maithili was one of the varieties of Hindi.
Which got upgraded.
And it is upgraded after they started the revolution that Maithili should be a scheduled language and so on and so forth. And now Maithili has become a language, scheduled languages. But right. So when you collect the bilingual figure or bilingualism figure, then the Maithili speaker says, I'm a Maithili speaker, but I know Hindi also. I mean, few years ago, he was only a Hindi speaker and nobody noted Maithili as a second language or the right. first language. So you see this de-dialectalization of languages. For example, Konkani came out from Marathi umbrella. Then Dogri came out from the Punjabi umbrella. I mean, these three languages were considered dialects few years ago. Now they are full-fledged languages. So it's a political question. What is a language and what is a dialect? A very good example comes to my mind that Hindi itself, which is which was Khadi Boli, the name was Khadi Boli. So it was a Boli, it was a dialect, right? Which was used for Hindustani for basically as a language contact. And Braj Bhasha, which was the name was Bhasha.
That is the language. Yeah.
It was the language. It was so rich. It is still rich. It has literature, written literature in it. It has all genre of literature very well documented. And it is a very old language of Braj area, including Mathura and Agra. But that became a dialect under Hindi.
Right. You see?
So, I mean, that's why linguists don't like these terms, language and dialect.
So, yeah, I was actually about to come to that. So as a linguist, do you see any distinction between language and dialect, or do you see this as a completely political exercise?
This is completely political exercise. Basically, what you call dialects is a variety. It's a variety of language. And we forget that languages also evolve, like we have evolved. And languages also change, you see. So when languages change, at times they become very distinct from each other in the sense the mutual intelligibility becomes little low. So then in that case, they become little separate. But some kind of mutual intelligibility remains. For example, if you take a train, let's say from the eastern part of India, Kolkata, to all the way from the western part, to Gujarat, you at the railway stations, you will understand some communication, you'll understand till you reach Gujarat, and it will not be able to understand. So mutual intelligibility. So these are all sister languages. You can't call them dialects. You can't call them their dialects of Indo-Aryan language. There are varieties of Indo-Aryan languages which are language in itself. So each dialect, what you call a dialect for us, a variety, is a language, is a total language, because it has grammar, it has some phonological structures, some morphological structures, the rules which are different from the neighboring language. So, this language dialect question is a very tricky question.
No, that's right. And of course, I mean, the reason why it's a tricky question is also why it becomes a political question, because anything that's tricky is also available to politics. And of course, language, just as a constitutional lawyer, the question of official language was the most debated question in India's Constituent Assembly. We found a formulation in Article 363 that was essentially a compromise, that Hindi will be the official language, there will be no national language, but English shall also be used for the first 15 years, and states which don't want to use it can continue using English. And then there was the Tamil agitation, and then the compromise that was reached with the Act of 1965. So language actually has a very deep constitutional history, and also a political history, because as we all know, the reorganization of states in 1956 was primarily a linguistic reorganization. And so that kind of essentially flattened some differences that exist between various parts of a state and gave this identity of one state, one language. So there is, of course, a development that Professor Abhi, you know of, which is not only one nation, one language, which is about Hindi, but also one state, one language. So there is a trend around several states in India to enact legislations that in the guise of promoting a local language actually enforces it and mandates it in some way. So the Karnataka Language Development Act is a good example, which says that any person in employment with the state government of Karnataka shall compulsorily pass a Kannada language examination. It requires the upper half of all signboards in the state to be in Kannada. So what, as a linguist, how do you see these legislations which are in some sense saying or symbolizing that one state should really be about one language, irrespective of the differences within that language, and certainly irrespective of other languages that might be spoken in that state?
Well, to begin with, this one state, one language actually emanates from the theory of one nation, one language, which in a country of multiple languages, cultures, and worldviews, I don't think it works. And it is some kind of an oppression, because one's ability and freedom to choose one's language are central for one's dignity. A seamless transmission of centuries-old knowledge, history, beliefs, value judgment, and traditions and general well-being. So all this is lost if we suppress the home language or the heritage language of the communities. So one language, one state language, can be used for education and literacy, but this should be only one of the choices. You see, one language can be the major language, but the three language formula that we had adopted was quite good. It did not work out because it was not implemented properly. And what I had been propagating for quite some time, multilingual education in phases. You don't have to bombard the child with four or five languages in the beginning. You can start with the one language, which is his, and the that brings in the concept of oral tradition also. The state should recognize in the early years of the child, the orality should be given a very big importance. These days, the orality is totally out of the window, they have thrown it, and they immediately come to the akshara gyan and literacy. Many linguists have written about it, and we have come to the conclusion that illiteracy is not a disease. Mm-hmm. You see? People, you think, for example, these tribals, these hunter and gatherers, those are our rural people, they have immense knowledge of the ecology. They know how to protect their forests. They know how to conserve the energy. They know how to, conserve the water system. They also have amazing water system and the irrigation strategies which we have to learn without. And those strategies are so good because they are eco-friendly. You know, if you go into among these people and reside among them, you realize the kind of indigenous knowledge which saves the earth from destruction is amazing. It's all resided in their language. So why deprive them of that when they come to school? So the state should certainly promote orality in the very beginning, in the first 2 years of the child. Oral tradition can be maintained. Teachers can be brought from the community to teach and to supervise, and that will also bring them some economic gains, so the language will be given some status. So what I'm trying to say that this is very imprudent, actually, and very insensitive to think that one's language for one state would work out, or one language for the entire nation will work out. The right to use one's language for expression and opinion in public life without fear of discrimination is a prerequisite to what you can say inclusiveness and equality, the hallmarks of democracy. These are the hallmark of democracy. Choosing one language over others amounts to usurping the rights of people in transmitting not only just the oral traditions that I talked about, but robbing them of their ability to express themselves and deleting a plethora of knowledge bases hidden in linguistic diversity. So mother tongue, I don't think, is an ordinary experience acquired at an early age of human growth. It's a vehicle of our cognition. It's a vehicle of our worldly experiences, and perhaps our most important instrument for shaping our brain structure, as proved by neurologists. You know, the multilinguality brings plasticity of brain, and that means this has been proved beyond doubt. So the first language of the child is the most significant asset for the development of cognitive abilities as well as for creative thinking. So we should not do away with this multilinguality, and we should not do away with giving importance to the very first language of the child. You know, recently, neurologists have proved that childhood multilingualism protects us from Alzheimer's and amnesia in old age. So this is an interesting finding by neurologists, which gives us another the encouragement, or gives us another point to promote multilinguality in state education. Because I think the right to use one's language, including sign language, should be enshrined, I think, in the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. And you come from the law background, you would appreciate
that. I think this is actually a suggestion that as lawyers we should take up, that that certainly in the Constitution of India, where the right to life is guaranteed to everybody, the fundamental attribute of life is the ability to be able to speak in one's own language. And the ability to do that without discrimination should really be part of Article 21 of the Constitution. So that's a great suggestion, Professor Abhi. I'm certain that someone will take it up in due course, and hopefully there will be an authoritative pronouncement from the court. But this is actually what you said is really fascinating, that multilinguality is natural to us, and any effort at trying to pigeonhole that into narrow categories based on European constructs of one nation, one language is really a crying shame, and we should avoid it at all possible costs. And this is a really good note on which to come close to the end of this. But I'll end by going back to linguistics, because that's, of course, your area of study, and you've spoken so passionately about it. And I'd like to end by asking you, given the political salience of some of these issues that we discussed, in your view, why is it important that the youth today study linguistics, not just as a separate subject matter, but also in allied areas? And we've covered many, like anthropology, neurology, law. There are several areas where linguistics has sort of a very clear overlap. So what is the importance of linguistics in today's day and age?
See, linguistics it has been important from time immemorial, I will say, because Paninian grammar written in 500 5th century BC, itself is a treatise on how well the language is analyzed and how the language depicts the society that was there. So linguistics has a language science, let me put it, is the biggest life science, because it starts connecting to the world or to the humans when they are in the womb of their mothers. Yes, you know, we start studying the language that the child hears in the womb to the stage when we reach the twilight years of our life, and even beyond, when the language becomes extinct. You tell me, is there any other life science which is as encompassing as this? Every stage of human life has a different form of language, different connection, contact languages. You know, as I said in the beginning, we are speech detectives. The moment we come to know or we come to hear 3-4 sentences in a language, we can tell you where you come from, what have you been, which is a migration pattern of this community. I mean, I worked on Roma in Germany, and I realized they had so many roots from Punjabi. And it's sure enough, because the Romas migrated in 13th century from Punjab to all the European countries. That's similarly, right. You have what is called Ghumantu tribes, or the nomadic tribes in India. If you just study the languages of nomadic tribes, you can easily find out the pattern of migration, the kind of contact they had with people, and what kind of contact they had. Did they have contacts with Dalits, or did they have the contacts with Brahmins, or did they have contacts with any other lower social stratified people? You see, we are really great speech detectives. You would need, I think, the combination of disciplines like anthropology, archaeology, historians, geneticists, and of course, literature, language people combined, to tell you what we can tell you in linguistics. So I think linguistics, and as I said, structures are very important, and the language forms are very important. Look at English. It has changed so much in the last 500 years that if I write a sentence of 500-year-old English, you would ask me, Professor Abhi, what language is this? It's so beyond language. And language, so the change is very good. Somehow people are very afraid of change. They think we should not borrow. Well, if you won't borrow, you will not evolve. If you won't borrow, you won't grow up. So borrowing is very important, and borrowing is not wrong. We should keep borrowing. This is how languages change, and this is how languages become different languages, as you were talking about dialects. So this is will be A1 will become B1, and B1 may become split into C1. You see? So this is what happens, and linguistics tells you, gives you the, it's a very scientific discipline. We have very scientific tools by which we reconstruct the protoforms, so we can go into the history. And just like in archaeology, you know, when you extract layers after layers, and you go into the civilization which is at the bottom of the layer, and you say this is the oldest civilization, this was their history, this was their sociology or social patterns, and so on and so forth. Similarly, we can dig up the language structures and go into layers and layers, and we can find out in language which is the oldest form here, and which is the newer form here, and which is the in the middle, you know. And this is what I applied historical and comparative methods and typological methods to identify this new language family, Great Andamanese. Because I compared it with the other languages, and I compared the words, and I compared the grammar. How do they form? Though it was on the verge of extinction, but I was fortunate enough not to have the language which was very much in contact with other languages. So it had one layer which was very archaic, examples of which I just gave you. It had other layers which were very modern. And then there were other layers which were most modern. So, you know, I could do that. So the scientific discipline that language science is, I think, should be studied by as many students as possible, because it touches every aspect of life. But it also touches every other field. It's a multidisciplinary kind of a discipline. Because we, as you know, the geneticists have been in touch with me. And so I have been communicating with historians, because they find many things similar or controversy, and so on and so forth. And anthropology, because they say you have worked on anthropology of mind, actually, through Great Andamanese. You see, I mean, literature, of course, because you have folk literature, folk tradition, oral tradition.
Literature, politics. I can see sort of its connections everywhere. And
yeah. It's an all-encompassing subject.
No, please go on.
I find it very important. But unfortunately, the government of India does not recognize the importance of linguistics. So we don't have many departments. And wherever they are, they're very ill-equipped. Faculty,
so I think this is a wake-up call. This is a wake-up call to all of us that why we need to study linguistics. I think Professor Abhi has made the most compelling case that we need to study linguistics to understand who we are as a people and as individuals, and of course the communities that we belong to. And we do it in linguistics beautifully through language. And this has really been Professor Abhi a Bongoi conversation. If I can say that, this has been a really beautiful conversation that has spanned a huge expanse. And certainly I have learned a lot, particularly taking away from the great Andamanese language, but so much about languages, why we shouldn't think about languages and dialects, and about how one nation, one language is really a flawed construct for a country as diverse and as multilingual as India. So hopefully this will not be the last conversation, and we will have another one in another season, Professor Abhi. But thank you very much for joining me today. It's been a real pleasure talking.
Thank you, Argy, for inviting me. But I would like to just end with one note, which is my strong conviction that it is a matter of injustice when people are forced to give up their languages by repressive regimes or prejudiced dominant societies.
That's right. Thank so I think that's a really great note to end on, that the struggle must continue, and we must ensure that we have certainly freedom for all to speak in the language of their choice. Thanks very much, Professor Abhi. It's been a real pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you. And namaskar.
Thank you.
As we close, the main goal for us this season is to encourage you, our listeners, to go out and vote. The simple act of casting a vote is what keeps democracy healthy and thriving. So I'm pleased to announce our special poll this season is called Free and Fair. At the end of each episode, I'll pose a question to you and you will have 48 hours to respond. Today's question for Free and Fair is it sensible for India to have a one nation, one language model? Should India have a one nation, one language model? Your options are yes or no. To cast your vote, visit my Twitter account. That's @orgo_justify. In the next 48 hours. Look forward to receiving your votes soon. Adjourn.
If you enjoyed listening to this podcast, follow us on Twitter @Vidhi_India for regular updates. We are on SoundCloud and Spotify as Vidhi Center for Legal Policies Podcast. You can also listen to us on Google Podcasts or iTunes. Email us at justify@vidhilegalpolicy.in to share your comments and feedback on this episode.